Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Thank you for listening and thank you for downloading this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. Trent and Leighton Kling with you. We've got earnings from Whole Foods to discuss, as well as expansion for another retailer in the U.S., as well as a retail bankruptcy. And later on, we'll talk about earnings from the Container Store. But first, we begin with a little bit of a surprise from Gap as they released a revised outlook for their fourth quarter earnings. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/retail. That's www.audibletrial.com/retail. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. We begin with The Gap as they released a revised outlook for their fourth quarter earnings as they look towards improved sales despite analysts pointing to less mall traffic. Now, Leighton, you and I discussed a few stories on the Retail Focus podcast that talked about decreased mall traffic, but at the same time, studies pointing towards an increase in expenditures for those going towards malls. Thus far, it's been pretty much split evenly between the haves and the have-nots, people losing same-store sales and people gaining same-store sales, most notably of recent vintage lids. And now Gap says that Old Navy is looking for significantly positive comps in their fourth quarter.
Yeah, this really came as a surprise to both you and myself. You're also saying that Gap stores are saying that same-store sales for the fourth quarter, the projected fourth quarter, are going to be relatively unchanged. You had mentioned Old Navy's gains, and then Banana Republic is actually still going to be posting a 3% decline. But if you compare all of these numbers, because they are relative here, we look at Gap that had negative 3% comps during the same period last year, Old Navy that had negative 8% same store sales for the same quarter of last year, and Banana Republic that had negative 14% comps. You can see that they're making a lot of gains. Not only are they making year over year gains, you're also seeing sequential growth with these staple brands. Of course, The Gap has these three retailers that are predominantly mall retailers, and that is why you bring up the mall space, and that a lot of traffic numbers have been trending downward for the mall space, but you see these sort of semi-staple brands really doing well and making a little bit of a resurgence. And so guidance for the full year fiscal 2016 is actually revised up now. The company expects its full reported diluted earnings per share to be in the range of $1.68 to $1.69. And then also you're looking at the fourth quarter fiscal 2016 earnings. You're looking at 54 cents to 55 cents per share, or about 50 cents to 51 cents on an adjusted basis. But even given the adjusted basis, this is well above analyst predictions. They were expecting 44 cents per share. This is a really good positive note for The Gap overall, saying that not only is the staple brand The Gap doing well, but also Old Navy and Banana Republic is making sequential growth as well.
When you look at the Gap's brands, we've talked about Old Navy, Gap, and Banana Republic. Astute listeners will probably note that Old Navy, not all of their holdings are in malls. Many of them are in the same real estate that Ulta and TJ Maxx or TJX stores have holdings in. And because of that, Old Navy might be getting a little bit of crossover traffic from those businesses that have seen success outside of malls. But you're right, many Old Navy stores, many Gap stores as well, are inside the traditional shopping mall. And what's more is Old Navy is kind of that secondary anchor store. While they're not in the same space as, say, a JCPenney or a Sears or a Dillard's or a Macy's, they are a secondary anchor where people will actually go to a mall to visit them, much like we talk about Victoria's Secret kind of being a secondary mall anchor. And this suggests to me that consumers are, when they're going to malls and spending the money that we know they are spending at the malls, they're choosing to spend it at Old Navy above some other brands, like, for example, Journeys, who have slacked a little bit in terms of clothing sales. Apparel sales across the board has been relatively soft, and even JCPenney, whose same store sales have begun to rebound over the last few quarters, and their same store sales might actually be very close to even in their next quarterly release when we get that later on in the month. they noted that there is some softness, especially in terms of women's apparel sales. But because Old Navy doesn't exactly have a diversified portfolio of products that they sell, they pretty much exist mainly in the apparel industry. This tells us that apparel sales have not died off in malls, and I think this will help to forestall a lot of the negative press that malls have gotten recently. I mentioned on a previous episode of the Retail Focus podcast that even though this is more or less anecdotal evidence, the shopping malls that I went to over the holiday season, and again, I probably visited a half dozen in five different markets, all seem to be busy, all seem to be bustling, and we're so focused on mall anchors struggling, Macy's and of course Sears Holdings have been in the news recently, that we overlook the successes in malls. Bath & Body Works, even though L Brands has struggled a little bit of late, Bath & Body Works has shown significant improvements in same-store sales over the last couple of years. We've talked about H&M before on the show, and of course, Lids most recently, and now Old Navy, another mall brand that's seeing an increase in same-store sales. And one other thing we have to keep in mind is more and more we're seeing off-price retailers like TJ Maxx, like Ross, start to take up some of these anchor positions in malls. And we talk about how successful the off-price space has been. Well, some of their holdings are in shopping malls too. So I think the big takeaway, not only a bit of surprise with the Gap's same-store sales expected to rise across all three of their brands by 2% for this last fourth quarter, but I think this helps the overall image of brick and mortar as a whole. Now, we can't see exact sales breakdowns within the brands just yet. They'll go more in depth in their investor call, which will take place on February 23rd. But this is an overall positive sign for brick and mortar retailers in general, as these three retailers, Gap, Old Navy, and Banana Republic, had kind of been cited, especially in early 2016, as one of the businesses or some of the businesses that are dragging down overall mall retailing numbers.
As we mentioned, this is a revised outlook for the Gap, and you mentioned they will be releasing official fourth quarter results on Thursday, February 23rd at approximately 1:15 Pacific time. But in addition, the company will also be hosting a summary of their fourth quarter results via a live press conference call and webcast about an hour later. So between 2 and 3 p.m., you can expect that, where they'll be looking to see those top line revenue gains of about 1% to $4.43 billion. And then if you look at the share price, news of this really helped the share price. Overall, you're looking at a 2.5% gain on the news of the positive sales growth across all of their platforms. Shares have actually been hit hard over the last 3 months, but they are up on the five-year low in May that they experienced of last year, where they had shares hit $17. And so they're right now trading around $23.30 a share. So up again significantly from that bottom number of about 9 months ago. But they look to be really taking on that momentum into future growth in 2017. We move on to the grocery segment with Whole Foods as they released their earnings after market close on Wednesday, and the results were fairly mixed. However, comparable store sales decreased 2.4%, creating a little bit of timidity with their future strategy. But first, we delve into their numbers. We see that the first quarter ended January 15th of this year, actually includes the holiday sales. We're talking about Thanksgiving, Christmas, Halloween, and New Year's for what it's worth, but the company saw a 1.9% increase in top-line sales to a record $4.9 billion for this quarter. But we should be clear here, when the company says record, they did hit a very good top-line number. However, they have been lacking a little bit operationally. We see net income come in for the company at $123 million, or representing 2.5% of total sales. Excluding two major one-time payments, their GAAP earnings per share was about 30 cents. Their adjusted earnings per share was 39 cents. So with the GAAP earnings per share, we see those two one-time charges, those adjustments there. And we have to ask ourselves, what are they? If you dig a little deeper, you can see that one is a non-cash expense actually related to store and facility closures. Whole Foods ended up relocating two of their locations, and this was a $34 million expense overall. And then we see a $13 million payout associated with Walter Robb's separation agreement. We reported back in November that Walter Robb would be leaving his perch as the co-CEO. And then late December, John Mackey took over and became the sole CEO. This happened on December 31st. Walter Robb, we should say, will stay on as a director. But this is a very expensive payment. You're looking at, again, $13 million. And just if you see that as a percentage of total net income, you're saying about 10% of total net income is what Walter Robb is going to be paid out through this separation agreement as part of his stepping down. So cash flow wise for the company, you're seeing that $284 million in cash flow from operations for the quarter, $245 million in capital expenditures. As we've talked about, they are expanding their 365 program and they are opening more conventional Whole Foods as well.
Yeah, and at the end of the quarter, they showed $1.1 billion in total debt, $1.2 billion in available capital. So most of those numbers are in line with, I think, what analysts' expectations were. But their gross margin did decline 43 basis points down to 33.6%. And they blamed that on not only cost of goods sold, but also occupancy costs, which is a regular topic here on the Retail Focus podcast as retail rents continue to rise and Whole Foods actually rents out more than a handful of their locations. Now, as far as analyst expectations were for the company were concerned, estimated earnings from analysts were 39 cents per share. So depending on which number you use, either the adjusted number that Leighton mentioned takes out the payment to Walter Robb and takes out the money non-cash related to store and facility closures, then they hit that number on the head. It's either that or a 9 cent miss if you use the GAAP earnings per share. But I think even more worrisome for me is they now have negative comparative store sales in six consecutive quarters. This dates back to their third quarter of fiscal year 2015 when they first dipped in the negative. At that point, it was 0.2%. But now over the last three quarters, we've seen 2.6, 2.6, and now a 2.5% same store sales drop here in the most recent quarter. And when you look at share prices, which can oftentimes show you where expectations were on the company, shares actually rose ahead of the earnings release during trading on Wednesday, February 8th. But after the release of these numbers, shares dipped by about 2%. They normalized before the market opened again on Thursday morning. But at this point, Leighton, their price-to-earnings ratio, sometimes we'll talk about it on this podcast as far as what differentiates a growth-centric company from a company that's matured. And their price-to-earnings ratio has come much more in line with a matured company. It now sits at around 18 after this earnings release. And that suggests that the market sees a limit on future growth. And in fact, their CEO, John Mackey, also sees a limit on future growth. It made news stories a few times that during this earnings release, he was quoted as saying that the company no longer has massive growth plans, no longer seeks more than 1,200 stores in the United States. Currently, they have just shy of 470, and they want to kind of hone in on their growth strategies. It says in the release itself from the company that they are adjusting their growth strategies, which if you look at the numbers means that essentially they're going to be shrinking the total number of stores that they are opening, which is bad news for a retailer that over the last few quarters has really relied on new stores and developing projects to bolster their top line revenue, because goodness knows they're not getting it from same store sales increases.
Yeah, mulling through a lot of the research you had done in preparation for this podcast, I was surprised about the number of negative signs that this company had given through this earnings call. Their quarter two comp store sales through February 5th were down 3.2%, including a 1.9% decrease in transactions and a negative 1.3% change in basket size. And these are the two metrics we often look at to say, well, what exactly happened with these falling same store sales? And you can see that not only are less people coming to Whole Foods locations, but when they are, they're actually buying a little bit less. So if you look at the basket size in particular, you see that that sequentially is actually increasing as a deficit. You're seeing a negative 3.9% change in total transaction count in quarter one as well. So these are bad signs for a company. And this is a company that has really tried to adjust to the market. They've actually decreased some payroll expenditures, and they've decreased the pricing in their stores, and they've had a lot more promotional activity happening. They have weekly sales now at all of their locations. And so I think this is a really bad sign, because this is saying that the company has not been marketing effectively, and there are a lot more competitors in the space, with the likes of Sam's Club and Costco, that have a much larger all-natural and organic selection that can compete on price, because we all know economies of scale really does drive down the cost for a lot of commodities. You're seeing the fresh meats have been going down in price. We see that with the Tyson's last quarter earnings on the retail focus. For the next quarter, they expect to close a net 5 stores. This includes 4 openings, 2 relocations separate from openings, and 9 closures, which 2 openings and 1 relocation already complete in the first 3 weeks of this quarter. But we expect a margin decline of about 85 basis points for the year. Again, not a good sign, but this has to do with the pricing pressure that the company is facing. And they're seeing greater declines in the second quarter and fourth quarter due to the acceleration of implementation of category management. We can assume that this means that they're going to have a little bit more managerial oversight. I think right now their store structure is one that basically sees just a couple managers overseeing all the functional areas of the store. So they really want to hone down these separate areas that are within these different store operations. But overall, you're seeing that CEO John Mackey, after release, isn't that optimistic about the growth plans that they once had. They had once seen about 1,200 plus stores in the United States, whereas right now they only have 469, but you're seeing not really a resurgence for the company. Therefore, they're going to be settling at about 15 to 20 store openings for the foreseeable future per year.
And keep in mind that that will include some store closures. And the headlines that you're going to see maybe over the next week will mention that Whole Foods is closing 9 stores. Again, that's not the entire story. We always stress that when a store chain announces closures, to pay attention to the openings as well. That's why we say they expect to close a net 5 stores. This is much different than, say, a Macy's or a Sears just blanket closing a number of stores without announcing any openings. But I think one of the interesting things is that they do believe that implementation of category management will hurt them that greatly in the short term. We talked about that margin decline in quarter 2 and quarter 4 that's anticipated for this fiscal year. And something John Mackey has said is they want to implement this category management, or basically parsing out sections of their store and managing them as independent sections. As Leighton mentioned, typically Whole Foods has a little bit more of a horizontal management structure, and you don't see the store sections segmented as you do in many other retailers, or at least not to the same extent that many other retailers will segment those sections. But now they're going to be managing each category as its own entity within the stores. However, when you look at positive signs, as we've kind of talked about the negative signs to this point, they did open 11 stores. They relocated 2 during their first quarter, so that's why they see a net store opening by the end of this fiscal year. They might be able to unlock perhaps some operational efficiency by farming out their ready-to-eat food operations. Remember, we talked on a previous podcast about the fact that they're closing their last 2 commissary kitchens during this second quarter. They already closed one back in the first quarter, and so a lot of their ready-to-eat foods now will be coming from a third-party provider, and that could open up some efficiency operationally, make them a little bit more flexible. One thing the company did note, and it's something to keep in mind when Whole Foods here in about 3 months releases their quarter 2 sales. The quarter 2 sales may be a little bit lower than they would ordinarily be, because the way the quarters are cut for Whole Foods, Easter has now moved into the fiscal third quarter for this year. So this is going to create a little bit of a difficult time for onlookers and analysts to compare sales from this second quarter to the previous year's second quarter. However, that should mean that in 6 months, when they release their third quarter earnings, those numbers might see a slight uptick, so it might actually end their string of falling same-store sales. They do expect overall sales growth of 1.5% for the year, but that is a little bit of a backtrack over the 1.9% growth they saw in this last first quarter. And as Leighton mentioned earlier, they're seeing negative same-store sales as a function of not only transaction count from basket size, and this is a turnaround from a slight positive that they saw in the first quarter of 2017, where the total average basket size was actually up 1.5%. However, the company was quick to mention that this was due almost entirely to increases in the number of items per transaction, meaning that the company is seeing a little bit of pressure from that food deflation or grocery deflation we talk about on a regular basis. However, when we look at their 365 concept, they are opening three of those stores in fiscal year 2017. But the real question here, Leighton, is their growth in that area going to be fast enough? Could it be that Whole Foods will never really return to their peak of a few years ago, and we just need to adjust to the idea that individual store sales will settle in a little bit lower than where they were at the peak, with so many competitors now, including a business like Natural Grocers expanding by leaps and bounds. We'll have Aldi that we'll talk about in the next segment, and Lidl also planning on opening hundreds of U.S. locations.
You know, I think that's a perfect tie-in to what you had said earlier about the price-to-earnings ratio in regards to its current stock price, where it sits around 18.2. And as you mentioned, the stock has slid a little bit in after-hours trading after the announcement of this last earnings release. But you're looking at other companies that are very mature in the grocery sector. We're talking about the two market leaders, the market share leaders in the United States, Kroger and Walmart. If we look at Walmart, they have a price-to-earnings ratio of about 14.5, which indicates a slow moving company, one that really isn't as agile as it once was. And then with Kroger, you're seeing a company that has grown primarily by acquisition, but as an extremely large grocery operator, very competitive with its product selection and its pricing. We're seeing a price to earnings ratio there of about 15.6. And so when you compare that to the 18.2-ish number that Whole Foods currently has right now, investors really have tapered their expectations going forward. They're not looking anymore at the store count runway of about 1,200, 1,300 stores. They're looking at a company that can maybe sustain 800 to 900 stores here domestically and maybe expand through different markets internationally in 5 to 10 years' time. This is a company that really has been hampered by the last 6 to 7 quarters, and one that everyone really has been just waiting to see a really positive quarter, but it's not happening. And I think that's why you're hearing the overall cynicism now in the management's tone. They're saying that while the stores are still profitable, they can't grow and sustain positive growth like they once could. And you're seeing how the 365 concept could even grow a little bit faster. But even there, you're seeing that in 2017, they're only going to open three 365 concept stores.
We maneuver from a grocer for whom market expectations have been tapered off to one that, if they were publicly traded, you would see market expectations soaring. As on Wednesday, Aldi announced plans to revitalize some of their U.S. locations in order to better compete with the likes of Whole Foods. This despite owning their subsidiary Trader Joe's since 1979, which has encroached increasingly on Whole Foods' market share over the past decade. Now, Aldi is a privately owned company based in Germany, and up to the last few years, they've predominantly been a value play in the grocery segment, existing in the same space as, say, a Save-A-Lot or an off-price grocer. However, they announced that they're looking to allocate approximately $1.6 billion in capital in order to upgrade nearly 80% of its current store base. They currently operate 1,600 grocery stores in 35 states. So as we often say, still a lot of white space for Aldi, still room for expansion. And perhaps they're feeling pressure not only to grab some of Whole Foods' market share, but they can see Lidl over their shoulder looking at U.S. expansion plans.
Absolutely. And when we are talking about the store count runway for Whole Foods, Lidl has one that is quite large. We're talking about 500 to 600 locations in the next 10 years that they're projecting over on the East Coast. And so this is an area where Aldi obviously operates as well. So the overall project here is to revitalize these locations to compete with these newer concept stores. And with that, we look at exactly what they're going to be doing, what Aldi has looked at as far as the project management perspective, in order to make their stores a little bit more sustainable, a little bit more modern and convenient for their typical shopper. So first, we see that they're going to be actually expanding the height of their ceilings to a higher level, and they're going to be using natural lighting. So you're going to see a lot of natural light coming through new doors, new windows, and new skylights. And they're going to be focused on environmentally friendly materials. So while they're not actually expanding the footprint of some of these buildings, they will be replacing the materials that they're taking down with energy efficient and earth-friendly materials. So you're seeing recycled materials such as energy-saving refrigeration modules and some LED lighting that's going to be installed into these locations. And I have to say, as an Aldi customer, these are well-needed changes because you're seeing a lot of locations that really are dimly lit and they are kind of cluttered, not really taken care of. And so I think this amount of locations is a very large undertaking, but it's something that the company has to do in order to remain competitive with all of the current and emerging players in the grocery space. As you alluded to, Trent, they're revitalizing 1,300 locations, which is approximately 81 to 82% of their current store base. We're saying that they're currently still rolling out over 100 locations per year in an overarching expansion plan. So these newer locations are actually going to have some of that energy saving technology that they won't have to go back and revamp. But overall, I think this functionality is looking to be improved. They spoke of increasing the main aisle width, which is something that I personally think needs to be done, because in that main aisle, if you walk down an Aldi, they want you to be down that main aisle to look at those seasonal offerings and those really good one-time buys that have a typically lower price point. But this causes congestion. You get a lot of families that are stopping to really look over and mull over the different items and product selections that may be new to that particular location. And that causes traffic for the person that just wants to get in, get a few staple items, and leave the store. So I think these are very good, logical changes that the company has decided to make. And I think the $1.6 billion in capital that they are going to utilize to do this is going to be more than sufficient.
They reference expanding their stores and the usable square footage in their actual company release, and I don't know that this will necessarily entail breaking down perimeter walls and that type of thing like we were talking about before the podcast, but rather making better use of the space that they have. When you go into an Aldi, like Layton was suggesting, oftentimes there is congestion in the main aisles, and then there's nooks and crannies in your typical Aldi that go very much unused. There's a lot of empty space in an Aldi, and so they're looking to make better use of that empty space so that they can expand certain store selections. One of those is in organics, and we talked on a podcast about a year ago about how Aldi is making an increased push towards organic produce and also shelf-stable organic items in addition to gluten-free items. They also want to make larger spaces in their refrigerated goods section for their fresh meats, and as it is, their offerings in fresh meat have gone up dramatically over the last decade, and they're also seeking to expand alcohol offerings in their stores. And this has been kind of an ongoing theme of the last 2 to 3 years in retail, as you start to see some of the more traditional 3-2 alcohol laws in place begin to be rolled back. And now in many states throughout the country, you can buy both beer and wine in grocery stores. Aldi is trying to make the most of this. Oklahoma, one of the more recent states to do so. We talked about Colorado on a previous podcast and how they are pushing to include alcohol in more grocery stores over the next 20 years in kind of an organized rollout. So Aldi sees the writing on the wall, and they know that they can expand their alcohol offerings in the United States, but to do so will mean that they'll have to redo and revamp some of their stores, which is what they're doing with this capital investment. The big question as far as alcohol and as far as I'm concerned is whether or not they'll be looking away from their private label branding strategy, the likes of which they've used to almost perfection at Trader Joe's and, of course, at Aldi. 90% of their current product mix overall is from private label brands, and although many states have gone ahead and given the okay to beer and wine in grocery stores like Aldi, many of those same states have laws against private label alcohol or private label beer. when you look at a store like Walgreens, for example, offering their own private label beer in big flats, you can only purchase big flats in a certain number of states in the United States because there are laws against private label alcohol in many of the other states in the U.S. And there are several notable examples in high population areas. So Aldi must be cognizant of this. And they do have some alcoholic offerings in certain states like Missouri, for example, that seem to be a little bit more aligned with their private label strategy. But no doubt they are cognizant of the fact that once they get further into wine and beer, they tinker further with the area regulations, and that also increases your overhead because you have to have certain certifications and also certain licenses. Some states have licenses to sell on certain days of the week. Missouri would be an example of one of those where they sell a separate license if you sell alcohol on Sunday. But overall, I think Aldi is looking not only behind their shoulder at Little, but they're looking through the windshield at some of these other stores in the United States, like Kroger, for example, like Whole Foods, that are also bolstering up their organic offerings. And Aldi feels like they can compete with these companies. They told Bloomberg that they expect to increase the number of shoppers they have domestically from 40 million to 60 million each month by 2020.
Yeah, and that's really the story here, in that their end goal is to increase traffic. And so they're going to do this by having a more modern, open, and more bright concept that customers can really take a liking to. And they're also going to be expanding their amount of revenue by creating more stores. Aldi talked about having around 2,000 locations by the end of 2018. So that's just around the corner for them. So they'll be able to increase traffic by about 50% if they execute well on revamping these stores and they execute well on building out their locations, possibly building in new states. We had mentioned they are currently in 35 states here in the United States, so that leaves a little bit room to grow. I want to touch on one last thing with the story, and that has to do with the square footage that Aldi utilizes. Currently in the U.S., their average square footage is about 15,000. What is interesting is that their wholly owned subsidiary in Trader Joe's, which is the closer competitor to Whole Foods and Natural Grocers, actually only has an average square footage of 10,000 square feet. So they actually have more space than their Trader Joe's. However, if you look at a conventional Whole Foods, who they're claiming to really compete against here with this play, Whole Foods has a very large footprint, that more than double of a typical conventional Aldi location with 35,000 square feet. However, if you look at the concept that Whole Foods has been trying to push in their 365, they're seeing that the average store footprint there is targeted between 25 and 30,000 square feet. So about 5 to 10% smaller than a conventional Whole Foods. And I think that's really what they're trying to target here. And then also, if you draw back to the Natural Grocers comparison, you're seeing that their actual footprint average is about 15,000 square feet as well. So I think this is very smart on their part, and that the space that they're inhabiting right now on average is fine. They just need to utilize it better to fit in those new fresh offerings that you had alluded to.
When we return on the Retail Focus podcast, we'll talk about some disappointing retail news, including a bankruptcy of one specialty store and some negative earnings news for the Container Store.
For you, the listeners of the Retail Focus podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Honestly, Trent, it's a great service. You had mentioned this at the top of the podcast. I listen to Audible.com, and something that I've really been interested in lately is real estate. I was recently on Dan Lane's Rental Income podcast, and that really gave me the idea to start listening to ideas about how to invest in commercial real estate. And there's an interesting book by Mark Thomas right now that's rated 4 out of 5 stars that is on Audible.com, Commercial Real Estate Investing, and it goes through all the how-tos, and it's for any caliber of investment expertise. So you can either be risk averse or already someone experienced in the industry. It really helps you to learn the how-tos of the industry. And for me, it's interesting because it ties into the idea of retail. We talk about lease rates going up overall, and that money goes to somewhere, and that ends up typically going to commercial real estate investors, either in the form of a REIT or individual investors or partnerships. So a very interesting and fascinating look at the in-depth knowledge that Mark Thomas has laid out there in this audiobook. Again, Commercial Real Estate Investing, and you can get this through audibletrial.com/retail.
I highly recommend it. Check it out. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/retail. Again, that's audibletrial.com/retail for your free audiobook.
Well, we move on to some bad news in the retail industry. Specialty game store Marvel's The Brain Store has officially filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, with the news that niche retailer has stated that it plans to close all of its 37 locations in the United States. And most of these locations are actually in shopping malls. So a little bit of a tie-in to what we were talking about earlier with the Gap and overall mall traffic. But a brief history of the company: they're a privately held company that was founded in 2008, so not that long ago. They opened a kiosk in a downtown Chicago location where they were selling brain games. They cited research and the need for intellectual games that improved the human brain's neuroplasticity, and they cite a lot of research. If you go on their current e-commerce website, that is all they talk about, is all of the different games and how they can improve the different functions in the different areas of your brain. But they quickly expanded and went into major metropolitan areas outside of the Illinois area, having brick and mortar presence both on the West Coast and the East Coast. Like I had mentioned earlier, their game offering evolved a little bit, offering different games that would be tailored to better outcomes. For instance, some games would be better for one's coordination, memory, critical thinking, or visual perception and word skills. So they were targeting these different markets, and as a result, they had a very wide target market. In fact, they had a lot of promotional campaigns that were surrounding the idea that baby boomers need to be better with mental agility. And then they were also targeting families that had children with intellectual disabilities. And then the common consumer that was concerned with being a little bit sharper during their work or life skills in general. So their website that I had mentioned earlier is quite good, but it was the 37 brick and mortar locations that they're looking to shut down while they're looking to still salvage their website operations.
Yeah, it looks like they'll keep their e-commerce operations up, unlike a few previous bankruptcies that we've talked about in retail over the past couple of years. Really, the question here is why, and you hit on something that was a little bit interesting. You could make the argument that they didn't have one target audience. Their target audience was vastly spread out around a number of different demographic categories, which is tough to do for a niche retailer such as they. But I think, honestly, the predominant reason why they went bankrupt is because many of the brain games that they were selling, many of the things that they were trying to do, have been reasonably replicated of late by tablet apps and by phone apps. And even if you look at commercials for AARP, they have brain games that you can play on their website. So there's a tie-in with a number of other things that don't require going to a brick and mortar outlet or don't require going to a kiosk in a mall. They have locations in 13 states throughout the country. Only 5 of the 37 are in their home state of Illinois. And looking at their overall revenue, despite the fact that they only had 37 locations, they did bring in more than $21 million in revenue on average per year since 2012. However, there was severe stagnation. There wasn't necessarily a shrinking back of revenue, just stagnation, despite the fact that they were growing out their amount of locations. So you saw downturns in same store sales. You saw location constructor be the main driver of just them getting back to even, just them getting back to average over the last 5 years. In January 2016, so about 1 year ago, credit facility was taken to support some of their debt and future growth plans. But as it turns out, they won't get an opportunity to realize some of the growth plans, as they cited a dramatic downturn in their holiday sales in 2016 that left the company strapped for liquidity. Now, longtime listeners of the podcast will remember the saga of Children's Palace, or the Children's Palace, also known as Child World in some parts of the country. And this is exactly what happened to them. They had a tough time with holiday sales 1 year. Companies would no longer send them merchandise because they weren't sure that they were going to get paid back. And that downturn in holiday sales absolutely murdered their liquidity. They had no choice but to try and sell off or claim bankruptcy. And in this case, we have the bankruptcy filing. It's Chapter 11. They listed between just $1 million to $10 million in assets, but between $10 million and $50 million in liabilities in its filing. And Mattel, among others, is on the list of their unsecured creditors. It looks like they have $115,000 or more outstanding for Marvel's The Brain Store.
Yeah, along with them, you have Little Bits, Crazy Errant Enterprises, and Exploding Kittens among the largest unsecured creditors for the company. But this really tells you that the company was trying to expand a bit too fast. They were citing tripling growth since 2008, but this comes at a cost. You have to take out a lot of debt in order to finance growing these operations. I think they should have taken maybe a different strategy in slowing down, becoming profitable first, and then expanding. You had mentioned that they are in a number of different states, a lot of different states, 13 different states, which is a lot considering you only have 37 physical stores in the United States. So perhaps a little too much, a little too fast for the brain store. But I really did like the concept. But as you said, there are a lot of emerging players in the space. And now you even have applications on your phone that can really help with the brain's neuroplasticity. And they help with the brain's memory functions and other things that people look to as improving brain health. But overall, really sad story here for a company that just wanted to do good, but just did not have a clear direction or a clear market to target.
And we should be clear that it wasn't just Brain Games that marbles the Brain Store retail. They also had a number of party games, which are actually starting to come back. But when you look at the party games that they offered, you talked about Exploding Kittens, which was relatively popular. That was a game that was put together in part by the online comic The Oatmeal. But then in other areas, you notice that there are perhaps some lacking party games out there. And part of it is because they required a brain tie-in with a number of these games. Now, that's not necessarily the case with Exploding Kittens, but when you look at some of the more popular party games, I think obviously the one that comes to mind over the last 3 to 4 years would be Cards Against Humanity, and that's not something that they were able to include a tie-in with on their website. So they not only lost out in terms of trying to build out their brick and mortar before making sure they could execute on an individual store level, they lost out because they were trying to build out the number of stores in order to just keep their top line revenue in place. But they also lost out because it seems like a lot of game providers were going direct to the public with their games. And, you know, you can include Exploding Kittens in one of those categories, because even though it's a very, very popular party game, it's available direct from their own website. And oftentimes the price point was just as good, but you could watch for things like sales or promotions. Whereas Marbles struggled to draw the attention to their e-commerce website that these providers individually could do. So a number of different reasons for their bankruptcy, ranging from the development of apps to just, you know, straight up spending too much money to open new locations. And it is unfortunate. But again, they're trying to keep their e-commerce site functional during this process, which is a positive sign that the company could one day break out of Chapter 11 bankruptcy and perhaps reestablish at some point their brick and mortar presence. Well, we close out the news portion of our show with some other slightly negative news from the world of retail. The Container Store released their earnings on Tuesday, February 7th, and a few weeks ago, we noted that the Container Store was one of the retailers that was in serious consideration for our bottom five retailers of 2016 in our year in review episode. This earnings call moves them perhaps a little bit more close to making the 2017 list as they continue to struggle, particularly in the same store sales category. They're still in their fiscal 2016. They released results for the third quarter ending on December 31st. Now, the raw numbers, their net sales were up 1.7% over last year's fiscal third quarter, which would be fiscal 2015's third quarter, to $216.4 million. However, the sales growth, while it looks good on the surface, has been driven almost completely by new store openings and a service business that they have started called TCS Closets. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. But when we look at their same store sales, their comps were down 3.9%. We can't call it technically same store sales because they did relocate a few stores during the course of this last year. Their Alpha International net sales were down 5.2% as well. That accounts for $17.3 million worth of a decrease. Yet in the last calendar year, they've added 9 stores. So you can see they saw just a bump of net sales of 1.7%. after adding 9 stores to the 77 they had after the third quarter of fiscal year 2015. And it seems like a bad sign going forward for the Container Store, at least as far as their brick and mortar presence is concerned.
Yeah, the Container Store management did have a few positives to draw away from this earnings call. Again, it was their third quarter fiscal 2016 that ended on December 31st. They managed to boost their income per diluted share by 38% from 8 cents per share during the same period last year to 11 cents for this quarter. And overall, they did open 4 new stores, which is in their strategic plan, and they had 86 stores in their portfolio overall. This compares to 77 that they had during the third quarter of fiscal 2015. So they established that they're looking towards openings in Cleveland, Ohio, Albuquerque, New Mexico, New Jersey, Staten Island, New York, and other areas that are big metropolitan hubs that see a demand for this type of concept. And this is really where they're going to differentiate going forward. They can't really enter in to smaller markets. They may not have the population that can sustain decent store revenue, but no openings are expected for the fourth quarter in fiscal 2016, so no openings for this next quarter are going to be reported. We see a great growth driver, as you alluded to, being TCS Closets. That concept has taken hold, and this is really going to help boost the bottom line for the individual stores. There are some negatives, as you alluded to as well. They are revising their expectations downward almost across the board for fiscal year 2016. So they're not looking forward to a great fourth quarter, and this includes some top-line revenue misses, now below their prior citation of $820 to $830 million, and comparable store sales now on the lower end between -1.5% to -3%. And these are very bad numbers. You're looking at a store concept that is fairly new, one that a lot of people were getting behind, saying that they are very high on this concept for growth plans in the future. And now you're saying that the growth plans are really only in their store count, not in store sales. CEO Melissa Reef said, "Our annual Alpha sale was impacted by selling fewer days combined with Christmas and New Year's Eve holidays falling on weekends." And this is something that was actually contrary to something we had mentioned on an earlier Retail Focus. We had mentioned that perhaps having Christmas falling on a Sunday and New Year's Day falling on a Sunday may actually help some retailers, and that those are slower days anyway, and that the Fridays and Saturdays would be less impacted. Therefore, they'd see higher sales overall. But this was not the case for the Container Store, and management really has a lot to look forward to as far as operationally expanding their key differentiators and looking towards new merchandising mechanisms and a better online interface.
Yeah, part of the reason they saw a decline in sales during this quarter because of where Christmas Day fell and where New Year's Eve and New Year's Day fell is because many home improvement and home organization stores do see an uptick in weekend traffic due to weekend warriors having the weekend off, people saving their to-do lists for the weekend, people getting organized over the weekend as well. And this is a pretty consistent theme we see throughout the industry, whether it's a cooperative business like True Value or even a business like Home Depot or Lowe's. You do see an uptick in sales even on a Sunday, which is traditionally either a slower day or a day where many smaller retailers are closed. But when we look at where TCS or the Container Store is having success, we've talked about their planned store openings and all of that, but they are struggling in brick and mortar. Where they're having the most success, it became clear, is TCS Closets. TCS Closets had positive comps of 1.3% for this last quarter. Basically, to explain to those that might be unfamiliar with the concept, this is a service-based offshoot of the Container Store. The idea is that they rely on in-home consultations or in-store appointments with customers to rework their closets, and it requires in an in-home consultation, a $100 consultation fee. This can be credited towards the purchase of 5 hours or more of organizing services. But get this, their price for the organizing services come in at $75 an hour. They have employees called contained home organizers that will remove and replace closet materials, including your clothing and shoes and that type of thing for you. And then they have a separate installation team if you decide to make purchases with the Container Store, be it shelves or hardware. hardware, any one of those things. That installation team will demo your current hardware and install new hardware, new shelving, all of that in your closet. So your target market here going to be families with a lot of discretionary income to spend towards their closets. You look at a $75 an hour organizing service fee, and in certain markets, mainly the markets that have container stores, a lot of customers won't blink at that. They'll go ahead and pay it because it's worth that to organize their closets or organize their small spaces. So you're seeing growth in this concept. And Leighton, even though this is a niche system, this is similar to what a few other retailers have, and other retailers have had success with this.
Yeah, even Sears, which has fallen on hard times in the last couple of years, Sears Home Services actually has done quite well in comparison to the retail business. And Home Depot and Lowe's also have different home services. They have a lot of installation services, not necessarily just with cabinets and closet organizers, but with other things as well. This is something that they've really prided themselves on over the past few years, and that they are a one-stop shop. They not only have the products, but then the services to boot. And I think they're going to have a lot larger product selection with the likes of the Container Store coming up and offering these services. Again, these services for the home, they include a lot of interesting details. A professionally installed closet, obviously, is the main thing, but they'll also remove everything from your closet in preparation for your installation for an additional fee. And your contained home organizer will actually perfectly organize and style your new closet after it's all said and done. So I think this is an interesting concept, and this truly is a differentiator, something I touched on a little bit earlier, and that management was keen on using the word differentiator, and that they're looking for an extension that goes beyond what other retailers in this similar space are doing. And I think their services certainly are doing that, and I think they are targeting the appropriate demographic. You're looking at people that are going to make a little bit higher income, that are going to be open to these kind of ideas, wanting to take care of these services, not really having the time themselves to take care of these mundane details.
It's interesting. In terms of store footprint and overall market cap, the Container Store, very similar to the Tile Shop, but heading in different directions, as the Tile Shop has been somewhat of a retail darling. They're seeing an upshoot in same store sales. And part of this is because they actually offer design services for free in their stores, does the Tile Shop. And even though in-store appointments are free under the TCS Closets program, they still do begin charging for too much above and beyond that. So that might be an area where the Tile Shop is seeing success. Now, I don't think that's keeping the Container Store behind, but overall, the Container Store has to find a way outside of boosting their margins, which again, that led their press release claiming to boost their bottom line in terms of earnings per share by 38%. They have to find another way to differentiate themselves outside of what they call responsible capitalism, which is really what they've been known for since they've been publicly traded. On top of that, they've often been referenced as one of the best places to work. But as far as top line revenue, they're not really seeing much of a boost from those things, and they have to find a way to bring customers in. I don't know about you, Leighton, but honestly, I'm not so sure about someone organizing my closet for me. I'm pretty particular about where I put things in my closet.
Yeah, and I'm not in the income demographic either to be able to afford someone putting forth that type of effort into my home organization projects.
Yeah, at least not the closet, I would suppose. I think it might be worth it in some other areas.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the point in the podcast where each Leighton and I select a story from the world of retail that we'll be keeping a close eye on over the next week or next month, and we begin with Leighton.
Yeah, it was announced this Wednesday that Dollar General, which is obviously a massive dollar store retailer here in the United States and in North America in general, plans to open 1,000 stores in 2017, this along with two distribution centers, and this is going to carry employment of 10,000 new jobs. And the announcement comes as Dollar General is testing some smaller format stores in the United States as well. So it's unclear as to what percentage of these stores are going to be their different format. But we do know for Dollar General's part, despite their stock price having fallen a little bit in 2016, that they've had some massive growth plans in the last 5 years. Both Dollar Tree and Dollar General have been expanding rapidly in order to take out some other value competitors such as Walmart. You see Dollar Tree really growing by acquisition last year with the merger with Family Dollar. So this is probably in an attempt to compete at a higher level with the likes of Dollar Tree, but this is just interesting to me because this comes at a time when at the end of 2016, analysts were saying they may need to slow their roll and that maybe growth plans weren't what they were foreseeing in the recent past. But this news is definitely good for those areas that are in need of employment. There are still some urban and rural areas in the United States that could definitely need this employment. Again, 10,000 people they're looking to hire in the next year.
Many Dollar General stores are in rural areas, as you mentioned, and you're likely to see a number of these expanded stores in those same rural areas. The funny thing is, though, Leighton, we just got finished talking about two other retailers that are struggling somewhat, one declaring for bankruptcy, and we talked about them expanding their overall store footprint without being operationally too successful, and that's something we've seen over the last few quarters with Dollar General comps or the same store sales suffering a little bit despite the fact that they continue to expand outward. My looking ahead story has to do with the grocery store retailer Kroger. We've talked a lot about grocery on this show. We discussed earlier how Kroger has been expanding through acquisition, and that's exactly what's happened is they have announced that they have purchased Murray's Cheese. Now, Murray's Cheese has had a store-in-store development with Kroger over the last few years. In fact, they pioneered this concept back in 2008 after announcing it in 2007 that Murray's Cheese would have a store-in-store concept inside Kroger stores throughout the country. And recently, in fact, in 2016, they just opened their 350th store-in-store location in Indiana. So this gives Kroger a little bit of vertical integration, owning now the company that oversees some of these store-in-store concepts. For those who are unaware, Murray's Cheese is a very well-known cheese shop stemming out of New York City. And in fact, they have their own caves located in Long Island City that house cheese that they are essentially ripening or bringing to ultimate ripeness. So Kroger now growing through expansion, but in this case, growing through vertical integration. And something that some of the early press releases or news stories focused on was the fact that Murray's Cheese Shop in New York City now becomes the first Kroger-owned store in New York City. But I see it more as a way for Kroger to control these store-in-store concepts a little bit better, to put their thumb on the financials and make these more successful as they expand throughout the country with these store-in-store offerings from Murray's Cheese.
And if you look at Murray's just really quickly, they were founded in 1940 and they have over 300 types of cheeses, meats, and other foods. So that really says that Kroger is investing highly into differentiating their deli offerings. And for $20.6 million, this wasn't that bad considering a lot of analysts are saying they have to slow as far as acquiring other companies because of the cash on the balance sheet. But this $20.6 million is not really that much, especially compared to their prior acquisitions.
And building out their deli selections will also help Kroger grab some more market share away from Whole Foods. As we were discussing earlier in the show, Whole Foods trying to scrape and claw to hang on to their market share as they continue to struggle a little bit over the last few quarters. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast, brought to you by Audible.com. Again, you can go to audibletrial.com/retail for a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial. For Leighton, I'm Trent saying so long for this week. We'll be back next week with Food Focus, where we'll be discussing yet another disappointing same-store sales quarter for Pie 5. So long until then, have a great week.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.